Hello and welcome to this special bonus edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is my friend of 38 years, Art Sousa. Art, welcome to the show.
Andrew, it's great to be here even after 38 years.
Well, thank you for coming out and thank you for bringing that party-sized pizza from Family Pizza in Westfield.
That's two party-sized pizzas from Family Pizza, which are almost nothing now.
Those are donezo. So way back in the day, you were one of the few people that had cable and we used to watch Creature Double Feature and Godzilla movies and stuff on the weekends. But then we developed a ritual every day at 3:30 watching Force 5. What do you think it was about that that we just were absolutely magnetized?
It was available and it was the first option from, I think it was a Boston station where we saw Force 5 and these robots. Before, most of the available shows involved superheroes. So this was a whole new paradigm.
And so for folks that had never seen this or didn't grow up in New England, Virginia, Northern California, and a handful of other markets that had this, Force 5 was a show. It was originally in Japan. There were five different shows, all basically about outer space heroes and usually giant robots fighting one another. There's a different one each day of the week. Our favorites were Thursdays and Fridays, Grandizer and Guy King. This guy, Jim Terry, brought them over, dubbed them in English, and they became a huge hit here in the States and were pushed partially by Mattel Toys for a while there because they certainly sold an awful lot of Shogun Warriors thanks to this. But yeah, we saw it and there's just these giant robots fighting each other and it was just endlessly fascinating. We were just every day glued to the television.
It was. They had storylines, not quite a soap opera, but if there's a soap opera equivalent to giant space robots, then that's what it was. You know, it kind of drew you in, made you wonder, well, what if this was happening somewhere near me? What if a giant space robot was available to fly or control or get me out of school early? That would be great.
What if instead of a small 9-year-old boy, I could be in command of a giant marauding robot that was fighting to save the Earth?
Absolutely. Much better than being Superman. Had to fly around and actually save people.
So the storylines, like Grandizer, there's a guy, Orion Quest, who comes from another planet, is kind of hiding out in plain sight in what is presumably America, but must be Japan in actuality. And he has this guy Panhandle and this woman Brenda and this other guy Lance that he hangs around with. But every episode, these people from Vega, this place out in the middle of outer space, I think their planet was facing extinction, so they're looking for another planet to colonize, lucky Earth. And so they're here to wipe us out, and Orion Quest will jump into this Grandizer super robot and battle them every week. And they had like a different super robot that they brought to fight with him every Thursday, but he always found a way to prevail.
Right. They called them saucer animals. Because they would come in a saucer, would split open, and this creature that usually looked like a lizard would come out. And curiously, that's when they were most vulnerable. If they had just stayed in the shell, usually they couldn't be beat. But when they'd spring out, that's when Grandizer would strike, and that would be it.
Now, Grandizer had an array of weapons. He would lock into this flying saucer that would help him fly around, or sometimes he would eject himself from that and be a standalone robot. And Orion had to call out the weapons. He couldn't just press a button. He had to say what they were.
Right.
And so then we're just sitting there at home yelling like screw pressure punch and rainbow beam.
Double sickle. Space thunder. Yes.
Yeah, this stuff became just part of our vocabulary, which then kind of leaked into regular life too.
Pretty much. I found myself as I was watching some of these reruns, when I go to log on in the computer in the morning, rather than log in, I say, lock in.
So Thursdays were Grandizer with one giant robot. Then Fridays were Guy King. There's this thing called the Space Dragon, which looks kind of like a giant, but vaguely Japanese medieval mythical dragon. It's a robot, but it has kind of this traditional Japanese dragon look to it. And its head would actually pop off. And that became the torso of Guy King, who would then fight another army of, they weren't saucer animals that day, were they?
It would usually be another similar robot. But the curious thing would be with the original dragon that the head would come off, that would be left alone while Guy King was off fighting, and it would curl itself into the fetal position. right?
The tip of its tail had a little second cockpit, and it would put that over its neck to kind of defend itself.
It was cowering.
It was actively cowering. But yeah, we would watch this every day, and you'd see the same themes coming up over and over again. There was the helpless guy in Lance, you know, on Grandizer Thursdays, where every time he would go out with his pathetic flying saucer and get owned by the saucer animals, and Grandizer would have to come to his rescue.
Right. And save the Earth at the same time. So it's like this double duty where you have to protect the people around you that keep getting themselves into more trouble than they should be in. And then, oh yeah, got to save the Earth too.
What do you think some of the themes are that were sneaking their way in there? Because the anime folks usually like to throw some of those in there subtly with hero arcs and redemption and saving the damsel in distress all the time.
I mean, there's clearly a comparison to Star Wars, where you find yourself on another planet and you're defending the planet against the evil without really specifying what kind of evil that is. I mean, it's not clear in Star Wars why everybody's so upset and the dark side, right? I mean, what is it that's really got their angst up? It's not really clear why the vegans, vegans, yeah. I did it. All right, it's not vegans or
It's not the vegans, it's the vegans.
Yes, although it could be, we don't know.
They could have foreseen this vegan uprising, right, and just been upset about that.
Carnivores being threatened by vegans. It's not clear that the vegans were actually after something in particular. And it's not clear that the Earth was actually defending itself. I mean, you never saw another government get involved. What was the laboratory in Grandizer?
I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
There's this little laboratory on the edge of a mountain, and they had a waterfall that Grandizer would sneak out of when he came out.
And that's it. They were really the only thing standing in the way of the vegans.
Sounds a lot like the Superman story, too.
Superman, like, you know, yes.
Someone from Krypton comes here to Earth, is living in secret, constantly defending Earth against these other bad guys from Krypton.
Right. And that was Orion Quest. And Orion Quest kind of had that standard angsty loner, almost like a Clint Eastwood character, except a little bit of Jerry Seinfeld, where he's just kind of whining about a lot of things. So you combine them, and you end up with Orion Quest. So he would be the Clark Kent. Orion Quest would be the Superman. And somehow he would change into this outfit. He would just shout out Orion Quest. And then all of a sudden he'd have this outfit on when he really displayed no other superpowers. So I guess you're left wondering how he was able to transform into another costume without having a superpower.
It's kind of like Superman with the phone booth, I would suppose. Just all of a sudden, boom, he's got his correct outfit on.
Where'd the other one go, though?
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
So is Lance then the Jimmy Olsen character?
He would be the Jimmy Olsen character, right? Feeling like there's something that can be done. Maybe I can do it. Or I can definitely do it. Oh, I'm going to do it. Oh no, it didn't go so well.
And he's so earnest. You know, he's so steadfast.
He is.
I'm going to take care of this.
Even afterwards. I remember some of the episodes where he was actually calling Orion Quest names. You know, being soft or going in the corner and sulking where he should have been out saving the world.
Well, on one occasion, Grandizer actually ends up getting some help because his nemesis is generally this guy, Commander Ding, who's like the leader of the vegan saucer army. And Ding gets upstaged by another guy. I thought it was that bodyguard.
But that is.
Yeah, and Ding repeatedly fails to defeat Grandizer, so the powers that be send the king's bodyguard or queen's bodyguard down to do his dirty work. And it looks like the bodyguard is going to finally defeat Grandizer and therefore make Ding look disgraced.
You would think so.
And then Ding ends up shooting him in the back, basically.
Absolutely. You have to do what you can to keep your job, right? And you got to stay relevant.
Is that the parable here?
I think it's a start. You do have to stay relevant, right?
And job security.
And he's not coming from a position of strength with a name like Ding to begin with.
Fair enough.
Right?
What do you remember from the other days? I remember there was Space Cadets that had Jesse Dart, and I used to try to make that out of Legos all the time.
Me too. Yeah, and because the Lego set came with that little antenna that you could stick little ends on to make it look like a staff.
Yep.
That was on Wednesdays.
Yep. And then there was Starvengers. Was that the one with like the three different robots?
Right. And then that would be the ones that created Star Dragon and the Poseidon and forget the other.
Whatever robot. The Porcos one is. Yes. So that one, there's three different ships. And depending on how they combined, they would make a different super robot. And Poseidon was not surprisingly the water weapon-based one. That was the blue one. So when the blue ship was on top and in control, that's the robot that it formed.
Actually, I think it was the orange one.
That was Poseidon? I thought it was the blue one. So I thought you liked the blue robot.
I did?
Yeah. The obvious fan favorite would be the red one. The
Star Dragon.
The Star Dragon, yeah, because yeah. I don't know why they didn't just lead with this, but... In every fight, there'd be the robots fighting, and then the Star Dragon would then make this move where it would like fly towards the wounded bad guy and then suddenly peel off. An energy ghost of himself would keep on trajectory and then...
Obliterate it.
Yeah.
That was it.
Obliterate the bad guy. Why don't you just leave with that?
Yeah. Just get to the point on this. We can get on to the second episode.
The same thing happened in Grandizer. There are certain rules that you learned, tactical errors, like, no, you don't pull out the rainbow beam until the other guy's wounded.
Right. There's a progression, and you have to go through the weak saucers first. You have to brush them out of the way, and then slowly fire a few warning shots that bounce off before you actually catch them in the same position they were in before, just as vulnerable, but this time it actually works.
So these seem to be the rules of engagement. What are your thoughts about this?
That's true, isn't it? It is the way we engage in general. Let's sniff out weakness, see if we can find an in and take control. And by the end, I don't know, we have a winner and a loser.
What was the thing we were talking about in my office beforehand? You had a bigger idea about this.
Bigger idea. Oh, well, it started with this idea of being a backseat pilot. And when you watch a show like Grandizer or anything that you get involved in, you're going to develop an awareness to the point where you're going to start second guessing what's happening. But that's a good thing because your purpose as a viewer, like in Grandizer, where it's basically a half hour ad, your purpose is to pay attention. You know, as a business owner, anybody who has ever seeked to put some product out, it's really hard to get people's attention and compete for it. You have that set up for you if you have a bunch of kids really excited about this program. You can sell your toys. But if you're paying attention, all your focus is on a show, then you're starting to co-create with it. You're starting to take the narrative into your own hands and see where that'll go. And that's why you buy the toys, so you can continue the narrative in some other way.
Well, they were certainly very effective at that. They moved a lot of units.
They did. I think you have one out in the office.
I've got a few of them. Couple that my mom bought me way back in the day, and then a couple that I acquired later in life. And actually, in a subsequent part of this bonus episode, we'll be talking to Mason Fitch, who had the good fortune to grow up 10 minutes from Mr. Big Toyland.
Wow. That sounds dangerous.
Yeah. So for folks that never saw the ad, yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes so that people can see this ad that was on incessantly. But this little mom and pop toy shop in Waltham, Massachusetts, basically became ground zero for getting these Shogun Warriors, at least in New England, if wow. not further. And they would just run this ad during Force 5 all the time. And I still remember it. Mr. Big Toyland at 399 Moody Street in Waltham. All we wanted to do was go there.
Yeah, I mean, that is the continuation, right? You get super excited about what you're seeing and you're thinking, wow, I could do this every day on my own terms. So the idea is, in watching it, you're starting to second guess it. I remember distinctly this time when Grandizer was totally captured by one of these other saucer animals and he couldn't figure out what to do. And I was looking and looking and said, look, your spin saucers aren't being held back. You could fire those and get out of this. But he couldn't. He wouldn't do it. But what that is getting to the point where you're creating beyond what you're seeing. And that means you're totally engaged in it. It reminded me of a time when I was in theater at UMass at the time with Rob Corddry. He was of Hot Tub Time Machine fame.
Yeah, yeah.
You remember him? He was also a guest correspondent on The Daily Show early on.
Yep.
And Bill Pullman. He was Spaceballs.
Yeah, yeah.
Lone Star. Yeah. Big deal at UMass.
They were there the same time we were?
Just before. Okay. Rob Corddry was there during my early year, first freshman year.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, in theater, we went through this exercise called yes and as a process toward improvisation. So The yes part involves accepting whatever reality you're in the moment as reality. So if it's an improvisation, or okay, say it's a giant space robot. You're flying this giant space robot. If you say right away, no, there's no way, those don't exist, then it's over. There's nowhere to go from there. But if you say, okay, we're flying a giant space robot, what do we do next? That's the and part. So you say yes, and that's a path to creativity. It's a path to improvisation, but it's also a path that we follow in everyday life. And I'll reference your last podcast, Death of the Sticky Notes, with Damian Scott.
Yep.
And you made the case that if one of your software engineers goes out shopping a solution and it's not the solution that's best for the client, and he's just paying attention to his own needs and not the needs of the client, then you don't end up anywhere. You don't end up with a working relationship. You don't have something effective. And I think Damian also mentioned that projects fall apart if everybody's not on board. And it's the same thing. You want that engagement. So the idea is to get to a point where everybody's on board and you have this vision and you have this experience, and then you go and see what's next based on that.
The right thing for the client might not be the ideal thing for you. In that particular scenario, Damian's company recommended a solution that they didn't even offer, but it was the right thing for the client. So, hey, we think this is what you need, and this is how you should move forward. By the way, we're not the guys to do it, but we can help you find some folks that are. And that ended up strengthening a relationship and leading to a lot more business for them.
Right. And that's what you want. You want a continuing relationship, and you want a continuing path toward the product that you provide, and you want something that's co-created. Because ultimately, paradigm shifts happen. I mean, they do happen. But for the most part, if you listen to songwriters talk about what they do, writers, anybody creative, they're usually referencing somebody that influenced them. And we're constantly building on things. And that requires that engagement. You have to be engaged in order for that to happen. It's the same with meditation. If you need to relax, how do you get in a moment? You're engaged. You have to engage your senses and stop thinking about what's happening 10 years down the road or what happened 10 years in the past. You know the other anime at the time, Speed Racer?
Yeah, I wasn't that into that. Star Blazers.
Wasn't that just after Force 5?
Yes, it was on at 4 o'clock. The Argo and the wave motion gun.
That's right. That was pretty good.
But that was another one where, like, you know how this episode's going to end.
Right.
They're going to fire up the wave motion gun.
Oh, yeah. It's going to obliterate everything. There was G-Force.
Yeah.
Remember G-Force?
G-Force was pretty good. Mm-hmm. A little goofy here and there.
Oh, yeah.
Not quite as hard-edged as your Force 5 offerings.
Was there much for anime before that era?
Definitely not aimed at kids.
No.
It existed. There were booms in the 70s and 80s, but a lot of the stuff wasn't really pointed at us or didn't make it to the United States because there was no internet.
Right. But it was a big hit throughout Europe. From what I understand, Force 5 kicked off the anime craze in France.
Yeah, in France, I think in Italy and Spain, Mason mentioned that there was two different versions of Grandizer there. There was like a Goldorak and another name for it. And then I guess in the Middle East, it was a big thing as well. There's certain Middle Eastern countries that also had Force 5, presumably dubbed in another language.
Wow. So those are the seeds of what the kids are excited about now?
Yeah, I mean, now there's a ton of anime about everything. You want vampire anime, they got it. You want teen romance anime, they got it.
They got it.
Yeah, the giant robot genre, I don't see them making a whole lot of new stuff now.
Mm-mm. I mean, the early 80s was kind of when robotics started appearing, right?
And we were kind of worshiping Japan. They were becoming a superpower, like everyone wanted to study the Japanese because they were outdoing us in manufacturing and
technology.
People could scarcely believe that at the end of World War II, they were rebuilding from rubble, and now they had become, first their cars were a joke, and now Toyota had made them a superpower.
Oh, interesting. Well, let me put on an interviewer hat. So what kind of impact did it have with you and the directions you went getting into programming, and the VIC-20 was your initial?
Before I got a VIC-20, I did try to build some robots out of wood unsuccessfully. It turns out that you need things that can articulate and actually make them move.
Right.
And yeah, I wanted to take this technology and be able to make something fun to play with. And yeah, I don't know if Force 5 was a direct influence on that, but it definitely got my imagination going as to what was possible.
Right. And that must have informed a whole generation in some ways. I mean, Force 5 wasn't available to everybody, but the concept, the giant robots, that led to things like Transformers and GoBots and Voltron.
Voltron. Yeah, my brother's between 4 or 5 years younger than me, and there was a whole second generation of shows that he grew up with that weren't really on my radar, like Voltron. I remember he had the Five Lion Voltron. He got that for like a birthday or Christmas or something, and he was all fired up. So, folks, we talked a lot about Force 5, Mr. Big Toyland, and anime. There will be links in the show notes that you can find further information about the show. Those are available on our website, which is at underserved.fm. That's underserved.fm, like FM radio, where you can find the show notes for this bonus episode, as well as all of the episodes for the first 3 seasons of Underserved. So, Art, thank you very much for coming down and appearing on Underserved.
Excellent to be here, Andrew. We'll do it again in 38 years.
I hope sooner, especially with that party-sized pizza on the line.
It's going to take that long to digest it.
It might.
My dad told me never to talk to strangers, or to recruiters, or to strange recruiters.
It's so exciting when the website gives zero information about the job I am applying for.
You take 1 3-month sabbatical and all of a sudden, you're unhireable.
You're not allowed to say it, but you're looking for someone younger than me. Joke's on you, I'm 11 years old.
Finding your next consulting gig should not be this difficult. Quite frankly, you deserve better. Syrinx is the consulting company founded and run by software consultants. We get you. Find out why our employees are some of the happiest and best paid consultants in the industry at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com. Find a better way today. Syrinx Consulting is a proud sponsor of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. Next up, we're going to hear from Robert Swifty Swift, also known as Nixon. Swifty first appeared on Underserved in Season 1, but is back to discuss a subject near and dear to his heart, anime. Swifty has a broad knowledge of the subject and has gone far beyond his mecha anime roots. Swifty and I have talked a few times about anime and how we both got into it when we were young, but Swifty, tell us your story about what was your first exposure.
Well, like a lot of kids in the 70s, I saw Star Blazers as a kid. I mean, there were other TV shows that were really popular, like Scooby-Doo or whatever, but I just saw something about Star Blazers and then Robotech, like those early robot shows that would be on in the Boston area. It was like Channel 56. In Western Mass, it was PYX in New York.
Did you ever see that thing where the kids would call in and there'd be a video game and the kid would have to say picks in order to have it shoot on the screen?
That is a huge part of my childhood. But yeah, right around the same time as that kind of video revolution was happening, just as it was turning into the 80s, when other kids were trying to be Mighty Mouse or whatever, there was something about the mecha anime and Star Blazers in particular being this naval epic where the episodes were not simply individual episodes about something, but they were building towards something bigger at the beginning and end of every show of Star Blazers. They had 99 days to save the world or whatever it is. I'm sure somebody could correct me. But at the end of every episode, they'd say how many days they had left before the Earth would be destroyed. That was just so huge to me. I was like, why aren't all TV shows like this for kids? And so that was my first real introduction to anime, even though I didn't know what it was or that it was Japanese or anything like that.
So that's the one that had the Argo and the wave motion gun.
Yeah, and I was huge into it. And because executive TV people didn't really understand anime at that time, I guess, in history, now that I know these things, was very cheap. And so they would just dump it into the cheap spaces. And there is no cheaper space than 5 days a week in the morning. Like you can just get the kids before they go to school type thing. You just fill it with, you know, something to catch their eyes. And I remember that Star Blazers used to be on just before school started. And I stopped taking the bus in fourth or fifth grade because I actually lived a mile and a half, 2 miles from my elementary school. And I found that I could walk faster than the bus would pick us up and then drive all over the Berkshires and then come back to where the school was. And so I could walk to school and I could do that in about 7 to 8 minutes if I really booked it. But, you know, that is just with Star Blazers being this continuous show with a story that was progressing. The end of the episodes would be like the sting of a very explicit memory from my childhood where things were really coming to a head. There was this big battle and I would have to miss the last 5 minutes of practically every show. And the next day I would see what had happened. But on this particular episode, I knew it was the end of the season. I knew it was coming to a head. So I was going to skip and be late for school. But instead, my mother convinced me that she would sit down in front of the TV, this thing that she had never consumed. My mother is an angel. I have tons of stories of my mother having no concept of what my geekery was, but feeding it. She brought me to Star Wars. She stood in line with me for Empire Strikes Back. This is a woman dedicated to the happiness of her child, even if she does not understand a thing about it. And she wrote a letter to me when I went to school. I came home and she handed it to me. And essentially, she watched the show and just recorded everything that she saw at the end. And it was just such an epic telling of the finale of the season to the show. And I can't tell you the details exactly. I know that Mark, the secondary character who was thought to be dead, is not dead, and all this wild stuff. And my mother wrote that note. I kept that note. I kept finding that note in my stuff for decades. In the 90s, in the 2000s, when I had kids, I found that note from my mom because I just didn't want to get rid of it. It was such a wonderful testament to how interesting the stories were. But I actually even think that my mother really kind of enjoyed watching it because I could certainly tell she enjoyed writing this sweeping epic of 5 minutes of an anime show.
Very nice. My mom was very supportive as well. We would watch Force 5 every day and I would just be like, these are the coolest things ever. And one Christmas, she bought our toys from Mr. Big Toyland on 399 Moody Street in Waltham, and some of them are out there in the display case at our office now.
The Shogun Warrior years?
Yep, that was it. So she didn't understand it, but she was like, okay, cool. So then you went to college, and I think that's when your appreciation of anime grew up as well as you did.
Totally. I mean, college is this way for most people, at least was for us in the 80s and 90s, where you go to college and then you meet that friend. And much like you and I were talking about, I love Robotech. You love Robotech. And my college roommate, Mike, who's amazing, he loved Robotech. He watched it on Channel 56 because he lived on the Cape. I watched it in New York and we found somebody on campus who had all of the Robotechs on these garbage VHSs. And we just watched them straight through with each other. And we were so proud of ourselves. And, you know, the typical college experience where you're a freshman and you're like, wow, I love Robotech. And they're like, if you like Robotech, you should see the real stuff. They're like, have you watched the Macross? And you'd be like, what's Macross? That's what Robotech actually is. It's actually a Japanese show called Super Defense Fortress Macross. And then just this world opened up and I was very lucky. This happened right at about the time that PC hobbyists and computers were becoming big. Geeks' hobbies were just starting to bud in kernel and all these other wonderful things. And right at that same time in 1990, what I didn't know until years later is that the MIT Anime Club, the West Coast colleges, had fan dubs and fan subs for years. But the East Coast really didn't really have a lot of that. And the MIT Anime Club in the 90s just not only did they serve MIT, they served. I mean, I had copies of anime from the MIT Anime Club who had been given to somebody who was a friend of mine who worked at a comic book store who, I mean, it just had to trade so many hands to get down to Stonehill. But then I found out that this was happening everywhere, that nerds and geeks and anime and manga fans were getting these wonderful fan translations of the original Japanese works. And then from there, you discover that anime is huge. There is such a volume of anime that we didn't know about. In the 80s, it was just gigantic. In the 90s, it was bigger, but more stuff comes over. You know, like later on, we'd find out Dragon Ball Z, the common stuff, or The Magical Girl. stuff like Sailor Moon became huge. And everybody's like, wow, Sailor Moon's a huge thing. And there are actually like 15 Magical Girl TV shows, so many of them. But in the West, we only see the ones that make commercial TV. Whereas when you're in college and you're in that college radio nerd culture underground of the 90s, people handing VHS tapes to each other, you learn more about what the actual media is like over in Japan. And you learn much more about the culture. You learn these little details. And that's how otakus are formed. You take one step into a genre different than big robots and suddenly find out that there's this rich world of storytelling that is just gigantic and fun. And so much effort and art is put into it that easily one of the most fun nerd holes I've ever fallen down.
So we have listeners all across the spectrum of, you know, are super into anime to what is anime. So why don't we do a quick vocabulary session and talk about it? So there's manga, which are the comic books, and then anime, which is like the actual animated stuff like Star Blazers, Force 5, Akira, all the ones that you mentioned. You mentioned fan sub and fan dub. Is that fans actually doing subtitling and dubbing of stuff?
Correct. And what's most interesting, fan subtitles, fan subs, was the earliest and easiest thing to do. And what is, I think, really interesting, especially with the volume of fan subs that had been done before this recent 2000s to 2010s era of actually releasing these things commercially, is no one can watch 80 hours of a teen romance anime and be translating every single Japanese word that they're saying and all of the road signs and menu items unless they truly, truly love the thing that they're doing. I know that there were dedicated people who would fan sub stuff that they didn't particularly like, but it's very rare. Most of the time when you see fan subs, and the thing I love about fan subs the most is at the end, the fan sub people actually put their credits up and you can see the attention to detail, see that they loved what they were doing. And if you have met exchange students from Japan, they were shocked, especially in the early 90s. My friends from Japan were some exchange students at Stonehill. And then I later on met friends who had been raised in America, then spent time in public school in Japan. And they're shocked to find Westerners who like anime. These days, they're less shocked. But back in the day, they were just like, you know what anime is? And for me, all of my nerdy friends knew what anime was. So to meet Japanese people who had no idea that there was this gigantic fandom. And this is, I think, why you see now there's this explosion of anime, because there's three classes of people generally in the world. There's the original fans of something, then there becomes a fan movement of something. And then when executives who have money find out about these things, they're like, wait, there's an audience for this? Let's throw some money at it and make money back. And so that is why you see all this Netflix original stuff. Or when it says Netflix original, by the way, it is rarely actually produced by Netflix. Netflix has gone out and
secured the rights.
And securing the rights, you could dive down entire websites of the history of rights being garbaged. Like Robotech is a great example. Everyone knows Robotech. They don't know Macross. And you'd think, for as popular as that TV show was, that it would be a huge thing. Like, let's go find the original. Let's watch the original. You are not allowed in the United States to watch anything that has anything to do with Macross, because the rights holders, Harmony Gold, actually, we'll probably want to edit this part out because they're so litigious. But they got this in the 80s and they sat on it like a patent troll.
Yep.
And to this day, even with the gigantic explosion of anime, this should be such an artifact of an older world of sitting on top of this, but Harmony Gold will sit on top of this patent forever because the original rights, the way it was written away, gives them rights to sit on it as long as they keep doing stuff with it. And they will do a garbage little amount and then sit more.
So just to keep their rights for like international Japan and
everyone else gets to watch Macross. You can go right on to YouTube on any day of the week, type Super Dimensional Fortress Macross and watch the entire film and all the TV series. Hundreds of hours. This thing is gigantic. It's bigger than Gundam, bigger than any other thing. Macross is like one of the foundations of anime, and you will never, ever see it. It's Robotech or it's nothing. And even with the internet, like I said, it's one of these weird artifacts. Even with the internet and the ability to go around them, they are so litigious that people will not dare.
You got involved with the MIT Anime Club. They were open to folks, whether or not you were an MIT student. What was that like?
That was amazing. So got out of college, a budding otaku, as it were, and started working in Boston. And during the boom 90s, you meet a lot of other computer people. And I met a graduate of MIT. And he said, once again, like, you like anime? I'm like, yes, I cannot consume enough of this. And, you know, because this is a podcast, I am not Japanese. I am Italian, Irish, Plymouth. I am such a swamp Yankee. It cannot be said enough that I have no idea about any of these things. And therefore, the shock of my Japanese friends is just so honest. And so my friend Matt, who is a bare metal developer for, writes bare metal programs to data management now, used to work for missile companies and other stuff. I guess his parents or grandparents were Los Alamos scientists. I mean, talk about a kid who was born to go to MIT. Great friend, great guy, great person. And they introduced me to the MIT Anime Club. And then I get there and I find out that the MIT Anime Club had been feeding all of the fan subs that I'd ever seen. They had been feeding all of New England and Boston colleges. Like, they were just happily getting that stuff out there. And they had weekly showings. And they have recorded on a website every weekly showing that they have been doing for the last 30 years. No joke. You can go onto their website and see a very clean style, every single thing that they have done. It is just remarkably well organized. And they've evolved. Right in the 90s, everybody was starting to get their hands on PCs and the ability to do these things, but there were still DVDs and then ROMs, RAMs, passing sticks back and forth. And because these things weren't authorized in the West, an MIT Anime Club actually had a really great policy. If it got licensed in the West, they would pull it from their library. Otherwise, you could borrow it from their library, copy it for yourself, and give it back. And anybody, not just MIT people. But the other great part about the weekly meetings is you would go to the weekly viewings and watch anime that you weren't into. They curated it really well to show you that anime was not just big robots. It wasn't just superheroes. There were all these different genres, and I would not have been exposed to the more shoujo or teen female audience type stuff, romance stuff, slice of life stuff. You know what a huge anime style is that Japanese anime fans love?
What's that?
Sports.
Really?
King of tennis, baseball shows. Take a superhero premise. Imagine the biggest superhero thing. It's their version of Rocky, I think. Like, they love that whole arc, but they would rather watch it as an anime. And there's so many different ways they do it, men and women, mostly men for the sports stuff, but Western sports too, like not just baseball, but tennis, or, I mean, there are shows about everything. And of course, now we're in the post-ironic era. There's like King of Cooking, which is like kind of done in the style of like a battle. It's in the anime style of battling each other, except it is over cooking, but all of the visual, audio, and story beats are that of people who are fighting. Like, if you watch a fighting anime, it's identical to a fighting anime that you would watch, except then they say ridiculous things like, "Wah, wah, we'll destroy you." And it's just, and that's another good lesson that I began to learn in college, which is anime is an art that understands itself. It understands itself, I think, as well as film studies. But pulling it back to college, I will say that everybody knows Ghost in the Shell. Everybody knows Akira. But the anime fans at the time all know Ninja Scroll.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember Ninja Scroll?
Yeah, I watched Ninja Scroll.
But Ninja Scroll, I think, was so many people's jump-off point, where they watched the animation and the style and the storytelling, and it was perfectly dubbed by the right holders into English. And it was not a kiddie TV show. It was visceral, deep, philosophical, cultural, and fantastical. But the art and the movement was so anti-Western. It was such a specific style. And once you learn more about anime or you get into it, you can see the blueprints, the DNA of Ninja Scroll. Ninja Scroll was obvious to anime fans. This is the state of where things are. Not this was some revolution that came out of space, like the Matrix in Bullet Time.
Mm.
Like all of a sudden people are like, whoa, Bullet Time. No, that's a video effect that people have known how to do for the longest time. This is just marrying it to computers. But then people have done Bullet Time for years, but this one person does Bullet Time and everybody's like, wow, this is crazy. Ninja Scroll hits DVD and everyone buys it. Every person I met who was kind of like a nerd had a copy of this DVD or would be at a party and pull this out and be like, you haven't seen anime until you've seen this. Ninja Scroll is just everybody's jump off point, which is kind of funny.
So let's say I'm already paying for Netflix, Hulu, and or Amazon Prime. What can I check out nowadays that you think is cool?
Well, the best thing about Hulu and Netflix is that they've done a little bit of the Western thinking for you. That is to say, they understand that there is some anime literacy, but they are not going to make you like watch a slice of life anime, though they might be on some of those services. But generally, if you want to say, okay, what anime is there out there? You go to the Netflix queue or the Hulu queue for anime, and not only have they put their Netflix and Hulu dollars into bringing these things to the U.S., in a lot of cases, they have translated them with dubs. And, you know, your otaku weeaboo friends would be like, you have to listen to the Japanese. I can't. I have a Crunchyroll subscription. I have watched a lot of anime. There's more anime than you can watch. Don't feel like you have to. And I start to fall asleep when I watch 15 episodes of something where I have to both read and watch. Like, there's so much going on visually. I don't know if it's just because I'm getting old, but reading and watching is just overstimulation.
Thank you for legitimizing the dub. I've got Force 5 stuff, and I have both the original Japanese subtitled in English or Japanese, depending on what you want. The dubbed is just so much easier to consume.
Yeah. So consume the dubs. There's some great stuff out there. I say that if you're just dipping your toe back in, look for the 5-star reviews. The stuff that is most popular will be the easiest stuff. And there is so many websites and YouTube shows about if you're a casual viewer for X, believe me, there is content for you that content creators have created. You know, top 10 anime if you are middle-aged now and want to get back into anime. So specific as to be like criminally like, are you actually listening to me? Did you type this search in my bar? No, there's just so much.
So just go in, search for A-N-I-M-E and...
No, like, it is a legitimately its own category.
Oh, so go to the genre picker.
Yeah, it's like action. And then again, anime is as big as all outdoors. So the sad thing about anime is they will not cut it down by subgenre. And I'd love to get some audio of us doing subgenre stuff because some of the subgenre is outstanding. And the best way for you to figure out if you're going to enjoy an anime, honestly, is watch the first episode. It is very popular. The people who make anime know that if they do not get you by the first episode, you're gone. There's just so much to consume. First episodes tend to be...
It's the pilot.
Yeah. It's like a pilot with a meta understanding that if I don't hook you, you're not watching episode 2. It's really easy to go on to Hulu or Netflix as a top level. Find out what is the most popular. Sample it. There's some really amazing stuff and some original stuff. It doesn't have to be cel animation. Everything is computers actually these days. Even if you think it looks hand-drawn, it's not. I mean, it's all hand-drawn. It's just hand drawn digitally.
On a Wacom tablet or something.
Yeah. And that goes part and parcel with kind of the Japanese work ethic, which is you can automate some things, but they never met a task that wasn't better suited to them to solve by having 100 people sit in a cramped room and doing it individually. Simultaneously, there are animes about making anime. It's kind of like a mirror looking at itself, but also hilarious. Kind of like Hollywood likes to make movies about making movies in Hollywood. There are animes about making anime in Tokyo, and they are correctly also hilarious and terrifying. They're kind of like a PSA about how you don't want to get involved in the anime industry. And if you really, really, really do, here's the vocabulary you need to understand. So the essential consumption these days are super easy. Everyone has a Netflix account. Everyone has a Hulu account. You go to the section on anime. And then when you're ready to go to the next level, then you'll want to understand what the subgenres are.
Very cool. So we have covered a ton of topics today, and we'll be putting a bunch of links in the show notes for folks who are interested in learning more about the vocabulary or interesting shows or any other topics in anime. Well, Swifty, thank you for coming down and sharing so much about anime. I am going to have an absolutely stuffed Netflix queue.
Thank you very much. I'm always happy to answer questions because, boy, it is big as all outdoors and I do not know even close to everything. So thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share this thing that I love.
Excellent. And we'll talk to you all soon on the next episode of Underserved.